A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. And I have to say, it's the most Daniel prompt we've gotten in a while. He was working on apartment move logistics, ignored the fact that his AC remote had failed in the other room, kept grinding through tasks while getting progressively colder, and eventually found himself full-on shivering under blankets. His question is basically, what is the safe protocol for recovering from these mini hypothermia events, and does the same protocol scale up for the genuinely dangerous ones? He's asking whether you can just tough it out and warm up, or whether there's a right way and a wrong way.
This is a fantastic question, and I love that he flagged the distinction himself, the nagging body thing, because that's actually a really important part of the physiology. Your body wasn't just being annoying. Those signals are your thermoregulatory system screaming at you, and ignoring them is how people get into trouble.
The body as a smoke alarm that you just keep waving a towel at.
And here's the thing. Most people think hypothermia is a binary. You're either hypothermic or you're not. But it's a spectrum, and the milder end of that spectrum is way more common than people realize. The clinical definition is a core body temperature below 35 degrees Celsius, which is 95 degrees Fahrenheit. Normal is 37 or 98.6. So you've only got about a 2-degree window before you're technically hypothermic.
That's not a lot of runway.
It's really not. And the mild hypothermia zone, 32 to 35 Celsius, or about 90 to 95 Fahrenheit, that's where you get shivering, confusion, the umbles, as they call them in wilderness medicine. Stumbles, mumbles, fumbles, grumbles. Your fine motor control goes, your judgment gets impaired, and you start making bad decisions about your own safety.
Which is particularly unhelpful when the bad decision is, I'll just finish this spreadsheet.
And that's the insidious part. One of the first things to go is your ability to recognize how cold you actually are. The hypothalamus is trying to coordinate a response, but as your brain cools, the decision-making parts get sluggish. There's a reason you hear stories of people in severe hypothermia paradoxically undressing. It's called paradoxical undressing, actually, because the hypothalamus basically short-circuits and sends a surge of warm blood to the skin, making people feel suddenly hot when they're dying of cold.
The nagging Daniel described is actually the golden window where your body is still functioning well enough to advocate for itself.
And the protocol for recovery depends entirely on where you are on that spectrum. For what he described, shivering, cold, but still fully functional and aware. That's what we'd call cold stress or very mild hypothermia. The safe protocol is straightforward, but there are some non-obvious pitfalls.
Let's hear them.
First thing, get out of the cold environment. Obvious, but people delay it. Second, remove any wet clothing. Water conducts heat away from the body about 25 times faster than air. So if you've been sweating, or if there's any dampness, you need dry layers. Third, and this is where people mess up. Passive rewarming is your first line, not active. That means blankets, dry clothes, a hat, and letting your body's own metabolic heat do the work.
Not a hot shower.
Not a hot shower. And definitely not a hot bath. That's the number one mistake people make.
That seems like the intuitive move.
There are two problems. One is called afterdrop. When you warm your skin and extremities too quickly, it causes vasodilation. Your blood vessels open up near the surface. That sends cold blood from your periphery rushing back to your core, and your core temperature can actually drop further. People have had cardiac events from this. The other problem is that if your skin is cold, your ability to sense temperature is impaired. You can scald yourself without realizing it.
The hot shower that feels like salvation is actually a trap.
It's a trap. The safe approach for mild hypothermia is passive external rewarming. Blankets, warm beverages, and I emphasize warm, not hot, and high-energy foods if you're able to eat. Your body needs fuel to generate heat. Shivering is incredibly energy-intensive. It can increase your metabolic rate by 5 to 7 times.
5 to 7 times. So you're basically running a marathon internally while sitting still.
That's a good way to think about it, and that's why you crash afterward. Shivering burns through glycogen stores fast, So if you've been shivering for a while, you need to replenish. Warm sweet tea is basically the universal field medicine for this.
Sweet tea is the Gatorade of hypothermia recovery.
Now, for the more severe cases, when someone stops shivering, when they're confused, when they're losing consciousness, that's a different protocol entirely. At that point, you're in moderate to severe hypothermia territory. Core temperature below 32 Celsius or 90 Fahrenheit. These people need to be handled extremely gently.
What does that mean in practice?
It means you don't jostle them. You don't rub their extremities. You don't make them move around. The reason is that in severe hypothermia, the heart becomes very irritable. Rough handling can trigger ventricular fibrillation, a fatal heart rhythm. There's a saying in wilderness and emergency medicine, nobody is dead until they're warm and dead. But the corollary is that you have to get them warm without killing them in the process.
Warm and dead is one of those phrases that sounds like a heavy metal album, but is actually a medical principle.
It's a core principle in resuscitation. People have been pulled from freezing water after extended periods with no detectable pulse and been successfully revived. There are documented cases of survival after hours of submersion in near-freezing water, especially in children. The cold is neuroprotective. It reduces metabolic demand so dramatically that the brain can survive on much less oxygen.
The cold that's killing you is also preserving you.
And that's why the rewarming protocol for severe cases is so different. You're not just warming someone up, you're managing a high-risk resuscitation. The gold standard in a hospital setting is extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, or ECMO, which basically takes blood out of the body, warms it, oxygenates it, and pumps it back in. That's the most controlled way to rewarm the core without triggering arrhythmias.
In the field, where you don't have a hard lung machine.
In the field, it's about preventing further heat loss and very gentle active rewarming. Warm, again, not hot, IV fluids if you have them. Heat packs placed on the core only, armpits, chest, neck, groin, never on the arms and legs because that would cause the vasodilation and afterdrop I mentioned. And you insulate them. Hypothermia wrap is essentially a burrito made of sleeping bags, blankets, tarps, anything you've got.
The emergency burrito.
The emergency burrito. And it works. The key principle across all of this is that you're always warming the core first. The extremities are secondary. If you think about it evolutionarily, your body already knows this. That's why vasoconstriction happens in the cold. Your body sacrifices the fingers and toes to keep the brain and heart warm. The rewarming protocol just follows the same logic.
Let's go back to Daniel's specific scenario. He's in his apartment. He's been ignoring the cold. He's shivering. He's wrapped himself in blankets. What should he have done differently? And what should he do next time?
The first thing is to not ignore the early signals. The shivering didn't come out of nowhere. Before shivering, you get what's called cold-induced vasoconstriction. Your fingers get cold, your toes get cold, your nose gets cold. That's your body saying, we're losing heat faster than we're producing it. If you ignore that, you move into the shivering phase. If you ignore the shivering, you move into impairment.
Daniel ignored basically all of it.
He ignored all of it, which is very easy to do when you're focused on a task. And that's actually an important point. Cognitive load suppresses your awareness of discomfort. It's well documented. When you're deeply engaged in something, your perception of thermal discomfort is diminished. Pilots, long-distance drivers, people doing complex cognitive work, they're all at risk of not noticing they're getting cold until they're significantly cold.
The focus itself was a risk factor.
And the fix is environmental. If you know you're going to be heads down on something, set a timer to check in with your body. Or better yet, fix the environment so it's not a problem. In Daniel's case, the AC remote was in the other room. The correct move was to go get it.
That would require interrupting the task.
Which is exactly the trap. The, I'll just finish this one thing, mentality. And then the one thing becomes five things, and now you're hypothermic.
The productivity pipeline to mild hypothermia.
A very specific pipeline. Now, once he was already cold and shivering, his instinct to wrap in blankets was correct. That's passive rewarming. The question is whether he did anything else. If he made himself a warm drink, that's good. If he took a hot shower, not ideal for the reasons we covered.
What about the timeline? How long does it take to recover from a mild episode like that?
For mild cold stress with shivering, once you're in a warm environment with blankets and warm fluids, you should stop shivering within 20 to 30 minutes. The shivering stops when your core temperature is back up to normal. If you're still shivering after an hour of passive rewarming, that's a sign you were colder than you thought and you might need to be more proactive.
What's the aftermath? Daniel mentioned needing to wrap himself in blankets. Is there a hangover effect?
After significant shivering, people often feel exhausted. That's the glycogen depletion. You've just burned through a massive amount of energy. There can also be what feels like a cold rebound, where you feel cold again a few hours later. That's partly because your body is still redistributing heat and partly because you're depleted. Eating something substantial and staying warm is important for the rest of the day.
The recovery isn't just, I'm warm now, back to normal. There's a tail on it.
There's a tail. And if you jump right back into the cold environment without refueling, you'll get cold again much faster the second time.
Let's zoom out to the broader picture. You mentioned the clinical spectrum earlier. What are the actual stages, and what do people get wrong about them?
The traditional staging goes mild, moderate, severe. Mild is 32 to 35 Celsius, 90 to 95 Fahrenheit. Shivering, alert, hemodynamically stable. Moderate is 28 to 32 Celsius, about 82 to 90 Fahrenheit. Shivering may stop, consciousness is depressed, heart rate slows, breathing slows. Severe is below 28 Celsius, below 82 Fahrenheit. Coma, no shivering, very slow heart rate, pupils may be fixed and dilated. They look dead.
They're not dead.
They may not be dead. And that's the thing. Severe hypothermia mimics death. The pulse can be so slow and weak that it's undetectable. The breathing can be so shallow, it's invisible. There are cases where people have been pronounced dead and then revived because they were actually just profoundly hypothermic.
That's terrifying from a systems perspective. How many people have been prematurely declared dead because of this?
It's hard to get good numbers, but it's a recognized problem in emergency medicine, especially in cold climates and with drowning victims. There's a reason the protocol is to continue resuscitation until the person is warmed. The Swiss have particularly good data on this from avalanche victims. Their guidelines say you don't stop CPR until core temperature is above 32 Celsius.
The Swiss are the world experts on hypothermia.
They are, along with the Norwegians and Canadians. The Institute of Mountain Emergency Medicine in Bolzano has done incredible work. And a lot of the modern protocols come from a case in 1999, a Norwegian doctor named Anna Bogenholm who fell through ice while skiing. She was submerged for 80 minutes. Her core temperature dropped to 13.7 degrees Celsius, which is 56.7 Fahrenheit. That's the lowest recorded core temperature in a human who survived.
13.7. That's essentially a refrigerator.
She had no heartbeat when they pulled her out. They did CPR for hours while slowly rewarming her on bypass. She made a full recovery and went back to practicing medicine.
That's astonishing.
It changed how the medical community thinks about hypothermia. Before that case, most people would have called her dead at the scene. After that, the warm and dead principle became much more widely adopted.
The protocol scales from have some tea in a blanket, all the way to hours of CPR and a heart-lung machine. That's quite a range.
The key is knowing which end of the spectrum you're on. For Daniel's situation, self-aware, shivering, wrapped in blankets, asking smart questions about recovery, he's firmly at the mild end. He did the right things by recognizing it and warming up. The only thing he did wrong was letting it get that far.
What about the rewarming rate? Is there a target speed?
For mild hypothermia, your body handles the rate. Passive rewarming usually brings core temperature up at about 0.5 to 1 degree Celsius per hour. For moderate to severe, the target in a hospital setting is usually 1 to 2 degrees per hour with active rewarming. Faster than that increases the risk of arrhythmias and other complications.
You can't just crank the heat.
And that's counterintuitive. The instinct is to warm someone up as fast as possible. But the body needs time to redistribute blood flow safely. The afterdrop phenomenon is real and dangerous. There are documented cases of people going into cardiac arrest when they were put in hot baths or given hot IV fluids too quickly.
The body is a delicate instrument that you have to warm up slowly, like an old diesel engine.
That's actually not a bad analogy. You don't redline a cold engine. You let it warm up gradually, or you risk seizing it.
Let's talk about some of the weirder manifestations. You mentioned paradoxical undressing earlier. What's actually happening there?
Paradoxical undressing occurs in moderate to severe hypothermia, usually when core temperature drops below about 30 Celsius. The mechanism isn't fully understood, but the leading theory is that the peripheral vasoconstriction that's been keeping blood in the core eventually fails. The smooth muscles in the blood vessel walls become exhausted and stop contracting. So all this cold blood from the extremities suddenly floods back to the core, and the hypothalamus gets a confused signal that the body is overheating. The person feels intensely hot and strips off their clothes,
which accelerates the hypothermia.
It's often the final stage before death. And it's one reason why hypothermia victims are sometimes found partially undressed, which has historically led to confusion about what happened.
There's another phenomenon I've read about, terminal burrowing.
This is even less understood. In the final stages of severe hypothermia, people sometimes exhibit a behavior where they try to burrow into small, enclosed spaces, under beds, into closets, into piles of leaves. It's been observed across multiple cases, and it's distinct from the confusion of just wandering around. It looks almost instinctual.
Like a hibernation drive.
That's the theory. Some researchers think it's a primitive mammalian reflex, the same drive that makes animals seek out dens for hibernation. The brain is shutting down and reverting to very ancient survival programs. It's also, unfortunately, why hypothermia victims are sometimes found in places that don't make immediate sense to search and rescue teams.
That's haunting. So you've got a progression from, I'll just finish this spreadsheet, to, I need to crawl under this bed, to, I feel great, let me take off my coat.
The whole progression can happen faster than people expect. In cold water, incapacitation can occur in under 15 minutes. In cold air, it depends on temperature, wind, clothing, and activity level. But the key point is that the window between I'm uncomfortable and I'm making bad decisions is narrow.
Which brings us back to Daniel's point about the body nagging at you. Those early signals are the most reliable warning system you have, and once they're gone, you're flying blind.
And that's the biggest takeaway for the mild, everyday scenario that Daniel described. Listen to the shivering. Don't override it. The shivering is your friend.
The shivering is the check engine light.
It really is. And unlike a check engine light, you shouldn't keep driving.
For someone who finds themselves in a situation like Daniel's, they've gotten too cold, they're shivering, they're in a controlled environment like a home or office. What's the step by step?
Step 1, recognize it. Stop what you're doing. Step 2, get to a warm environment. If you can't change the environment, add layers immediately. Step 3, remove any damp clothing. Even slight dampness from sweat accelerates heat loss. Step 4, passive rewarming. Blankets, hat, warm socks. Most heat loss is from the head and neck, so cover those. Step 5, warm, not hot, beverages. Herbal tea, warm water with honey, broth. Avoid caffeine initially because it's a vasoconstrictor and can actually make your extremities colder. Avoid alcohol entirely. It causes vasodilation and accelerates heat loss, even though it feels warming.
Oh, alcohol is the classic trap. The brandy and the saint go.
Which is a myth, by the way. Bernards never carried brandy barrels. That was invented by a painter in the 1800s. But the myth persists, and it's dangerous. Alcohol in a cold person is a terrible idea.
Bernard thing is a myth?
The dogs were used for rescue in the Swiss Alps, but they carried supplies, not brandy. The brandy barrel was added in a painting by Edwin Landseer in 1820, and it stuck in the popular imagination.
I feel like my entire childhood understanding of alpine rescue has been undermined.
Welcome to my world. But the real protocol the monks used at the St. Bernard Hospice was actually quite sophisticated for its time. They would wrap rescued travelers in warm blankets, give them warm broth, and use body heat from the dogs. The dogs would lie on either side of the person. That's a form of active external rewarming, and it's still a valid field technique.
The dogs as heating pads.
Very effective heating pads. A large dog has a body temperature slightly higher than a human, around 38 to 39 Celsius, or about 100 to 102 Fahrenheit. Perfect for gentle rewarming.
The real story is better than the myth, just less marketable.
Much less marketable. Here, have some warm broth and lie next to this dog. Doesn't have the same dramatic flair as a brandy barrel around a dog's neck.
Let's talk about the special populations here. Are there groups that are more vulnerable to this kind of thing?
The elderly are at much higher risk. Their thermoregulation is less efficient. They often have less subcutaneous fat, and they may be on medications that impair temperature regulation, beta blockers, for instance. They also tend to have a diminished shivering response. Infants are also high risk because they have a high surface area to volume ratio and can't shiver effectively.
People with certain medical conditions?
Diabetes, hypothyroidism, and any condition that impairs circulation or metabolism. People with peripheral neuropathy might not feel the cold in their extremities. People who are malnourished or dehydrated are more susceptible. And there's an important interaction with alcohol and drug use that goes beyond the acute vasodilation effect. Chronic alcohol use can cause neuropathy and impair the body's ability to regulate temperature long term.
What about the mental health angle? Daniel's scenario was essentially a hyperfocus problem. Is that documented?
It is, though not as extensively as I'd like. There's research on what's called attentional narrowing in extreme environments. When people are in survival situations, they sometimes fixate on one task to the exclusion of bodily signals. But the milder, everyday version, the desk worker who ignores being cold because they're in flow state, that's understudied. Anecdotally, it's extremely common.
The flow state as a mild danger to your thermoregulation.
I think that's fair, and it connects to a broader point about modern life. We've gotten very good at overriding our body's signals. We ignore hunger to finish a meeting. We ignore the need to pee on a road trip. We ignore being cold because the task feels more important, and most of the time we get away with it. But the body keeps score.
The body keeps score. That's a good line.
It's not mine, but it applies here. The thermoregulatory system is ancient and powerful, and it will eventually override your prefrontal cortex whether you like it or not. The question is whether you listen before it gets to the shivering, confusion, and poor decision-making stage.
What's the weirdest hypothermia fact you've got? Something that doesn't fit neatly into the protocol discussion but is worth knowing.
There's a phenomenon called Hunter's response, or the Lewis wave. It's most common in people who have repeated cold exposure to their hands. Fishermen, hunters, outdoor workers. When their hands are exposed to cold, instead of staying vasoconstricted the whole time, the blood vessels periodically dilate for a few minutes, flooding the fingers with warm blood, then constrict again. It's a cyclical adaptation that reduces the risk of frostbite.
The body learns to microdose warmth to the extremities.
It's a conditioned response. And it's one of the few examples of the body overriding its own core first priority. The mechanism isn't fully understood, but it appears to be mediated by local factors in the blood vessel walls rather than central nervous system control.
Can you train that?
Repeated cold exposure over weeks can induce it. It's been studied in fish filleters in Norway, among others. People who work with cold fish all day develop this adaptation. Their hands stay warmer and more functional than you'd expect, given the conditions.
The Norwegian fish filleter as the pinnacle of human cold adaptation.
A very specific pinnacle. But it illustrates a broader point. The human body is remarkably adaptable to cold, but the adaptation is specific to the type of exposure. The fish filleter's hands are adapted, but that doesn't mean the rest of their body is any more cold tolerant than anyone else's.
There's no universal cold resistance. It's all local and task-specific.
Which is why someone can be perfectly comfortable in a cold office while typing, but the moment they stop moving and generating heat, they get cold. The metabolic heat from even small muscle movements makes a significant difference.
That explains the shivering, actually. The body's first response isn't to make you uncomfortable. It's to generate heat through muscle activity. The discomfort is the signal to do something about it.
Shivering is your body's built-in heater. It's not a symptom of hypothermia, it's the prevention mechanism. When the shivering stops in a cold person, that's when you should be truly alarmed.
Because the heater has given up.
Because the heater has run out of fuel, or the thermostat is broken. Either way, it's a sign that the system is failing.
Let's circle back to the practical question that started all this. For someone who's had a mild cold stress episode, the shivering, the blankets, the whole thing, is there anything they should do in the hours afterward?
A few things. 1. Stay warm. Don't jump back into the cold environment. 2. Eat something substantial. Your glycogen stores are depleted. Cold-induced diuresis is a real thing. Your kidneys produce more urine in the cold, so you may be mildly dehydrated. 4. Watch for any lingering effects. If you feel confused, unusually fatigued, or if your coordination is off, that's a sign you were colder than you thought and you should take it seriously.
Cold-induced diuresis. That's a new one for me.
It's one of those weird physiological responses. When you're cold, your blood vessels in the extremities constrict, which increases the blood volume in your core. Your body senses the increased central blood volume and responds by making you pee. It's the same mechanism that makes you need to pee when you're nervous, interestingly.
Being cold makes you pee, which dehydrates you, which makes you more vulnerable to cold. That's a vicious cycle.
And it's one of the reasons hydration is important in cold environments, even though people don't think of it the way they do in hot environments.
What about the psychological side? Daniel's prompt had this undertone of, I can't believe I let this happen. Is there a shame component to this?
I think there often is, especially with mild hypothermia. People feel stupid. I was just sitting at my desk. How did I get hypothermic? But the physiology doesn't care about the social context. Your body loses heat based on the temperature gradient, your insulation, and your metabolic heat production. It doesn't matter whether you're summiting Everest or ignoring a broken AC remote. The physics is the same.
Hypothermia doesn't care about your dignity.
It really doesn't. And I think normalizing the mild end of the spectrum is actually important. People should know that you can get meaningfully cold in perfectly mundane circumstances, and the recovery protocol is the same whether you're an Arctic explorer or a guy who couldn't be bothered to walk to the other room for the remote.
The democratic nature of thermodynamics.
Thermodynamics is profoundly egalitarian. Heat always flows from warmer to colder. No exceptions, no special treatment.
All right. So to synthesize the protocol for the mild end, the Daniel scenario, stay warm for hours afterward. Don't take a hot shower. Don't drink alcohol. Listen to your body next time.
That's it. And for the severe end, the person who's confused, not shivering, losing consciousness, handle gently, warm the core only, get medical help immediately, and don't give up until they're warm and dead.
Warm and dead? Still sounds like a metal album.
I'd listen to it.
I know you would. You'd probably have a whole playlist called Medical Phrases That Sound Like Band Names.
I'm not going to deny that. Paradoxical Undressing would be a great name for a post-punk group.
Now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
The name of the Japanese textile dyeing technique, shibori, is thought to share a linguistic root with the name of the island of Sakhalin, both possibly deriving from an ancient Ainu word meaning to twist or to wring. By the 1960s, traditional indigo shibori had become a niche craft practiced mainly by aging artisans in rural Japan, nearly vanishing before a revival movement began.
Right.
I don't know what to do with the fact that the Ainu word for twisting connects a Japanese dye technique to a Russian island, but here we are.
So here's the thing I keep coming back to. Daniel's prompt was about a mundane moment, a broken remote, a cold apartment, a stubborn refusal to stop working. And it opened up this whole spectrum from sweet tea and blankets to ECMO machines and people being brought back from the dead. The distance between I'm a little cold and we need a heart-lung machine is not as wide as people think.
And the unifying principle across the whole spectrum is that rewarming has to be gradual and core first. Whether you're wrapping someone in a sleepy bag or running them on bypass, the principle is the same. Don't rush it. Don't warm the surface before the center. Let the body adapt.
The body is something you negotiate with, not something you command.
I think that's the deeper lesson here. The body has its own logic, its own priorities, its own timeline. You can ignore the signals for a while, but you're not overriding them. You're just delaying the response, and the bill always comes due.
Sometimes with interest.
Sometimes with compounding interest and a late fee.
This has been my weird prompts. Thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop for the fact that sent us all down an etymological rabbit hole involving Ainu linguistics and Japanese textile arts. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. It helps other people find the show. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. Stay warm and go get the remote next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear holes. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.